Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorders Society. I'm Professor Ruth Walker from the James J. Peters Veterans Affairs Medical Center in the Bronx and Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City, and I'm the guest editor for this special series on chorea. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Professor Eleanor Morrow, who is Professor of Neurology at the Grenoble Alpes University and the University Hospital in Grenoble, France. She will be discussing management of chorea with a special focus upon Huntington's disease and the role of deep brain stimulation and other surgical interventions. So, hello, Eleanor. Thank you again for taking the time to discuss this topic. So my first question, so many patients with choreic disorders, especially those of a neurodegenerative etiology, present with a spectrum of neuropsychiatric symptoms. How do you approach them from a management point of view, and how and when do you decide to treat the chorea specifically?
So first of all, thank you very much, Ruth, for inviting me to this nice, beautiful series of podcasts. So to go directly to your question, indeed, you're right? So patients with the hereditary neurodegenerative disorder like Huntington disease, as you mentioned, the Huntington, like the SCAR17, the C9orf72, neuroacanthocytosis, but also patients with autoimmune chorea like lupus-induced or the Sydenham chorea, they present with several neuropsychiatric symptoms, especially anxiety, depression, OCD, apathy, suicide attempts, unfortunately, frontal behavior, agitation, irritability, aggression, hallucination, psychosis, cognitive decline, and dementia. We have this really broad spectrum of, as you said, the neuropsychiatric symptoms, which sometimes, and I will say often, in Huntington disease are a big issue, much more than chorea, as we know, right? We can manage as a neurology chorea much better than all the other neuropsychiatric symptoms. So what especially in Huntington disease, in the young people, the neuropsychiatric part is really very strong. And so in the ideal world where we can have a very nice colleagues and a very nice team, the idea is to have a psychiatrist first who is involved in the team, and then a psychologist, a neuropsychologist, people who can really help in a multidisciplinary management of the patients. This is in the ideal world. Very often we know we lack of psychiatrists everywhere, so it's very difficult to have them helping us, also because they don't think that a Huntington disease belongs to them. So what I do, I try to manage by myself mild or relatively simple symptoms. For example, depression, if it's not reached the severity of a suicide attempt, of course, or very severe one, with usually an SSRI. In Huntington, especially venlafaxin, because of the interaction with the other drugs, I can use mirtazapine, especially if we have sleep issues, some tricyclic antidepressant with caution, and also benzodiazepine, neuroleptic. We will go through these mood stabilizer agents. But again, often, in some patients, really, we need to get them hospitalized in some psychiatry ward, right? Especially if the depression is severe, as I said, the suicide attempts. We can't do this in neurological wards because we are not equipped for the safety of these patients. So what you said really stresses the need of having a multidisciplinary team in treating especially Huntington disease.
Absolutely. These, you know, obviously critical points. And yes, definitely I'm often, much more often called because my patients with Huntington's have been admitted to psychiatry with some issue. And yes, we often end up managing the psychiatric aspects. So let's focus a little bit more on the movement disorder, the chorea specifically. And so how do you decide when the chorea needs to be treated and what do you use? How do you approach that patient?
So because what we said before, and often it depends also on the age, this neuropsychiatry issue can be the most relevant for the patient, the family. Chorea becomes relevant when really affects the quality of life of the patients, the activity of daily living. So when really there is a disability induced by chorea, we can say when the severity of the movements, they interfere, really, the abnormal movements in the management of the ordinary quality of life. So that, I think, also for dystonia, is not for chorea, is the trigger, right? Which tells the neurologist, maybe we need to start a treatment for chorea. And we have to balance also all the side effects of the treatment, right? Because we know that when we start any kind of treatment, we have to be sure that we don't make the patient more miserable of what he is or she is already. So this is just when I start. And then the classical management. For Huntington disease, there are some guidelines that in Europe are available, in Germany. We know that the Movement Society has just an evidence-based recommendation. It was in 2021. And then if we use this recommendation, what we see right away, that actually a specific treatment in this is rare. We have just tetrabenazine, this presynaptic vesicular monoamine transporter 2, which are well recognized by this paper as the most effective treatment for Huntington disease for the motor point of view. I think you know, Ruth, that in Europe, we only have tetrabenazine. In the FDA has approved in the United States deutetrabenazine. You have also valbenazine. So we don't have, unfortunately, these drugs. And as far as I know, these are as good as tetrabenazine. And also you have a less severe side effect profiles, especially depression, right? So you have a little less depression as a side effect compared to tetrabenazine. So my experience then is most focused in tetrabenazine. But it's interesting also to know that the German recommendation, they also value thiaprid, which is a postsynaptic inhibitors of D2 and D3 receptors for the profile of the side effects. Compared to tetrabenazine, there are less depression, akathisia, and Parkinsonism. So some countries, they really prefer also to use thiaprid or to use both the combination of tetrabenazine and thiaprid, but a lower doses to minimize the side effects of tetrabenazine. I have to say that I personally like aripiprazole because also has this mood stabilizer effect. So patients are a bit more relaxed and less anxious. They can function a little bit. I'm also a fan of haloperidol because we know this drug very well. And I think the side effects are acceptable. Maybe doesn't have all the depression of olanzapine, of tetrabenazine, but also you can use olanzapine, risperidone, benzodiazepine if you have all the side effects of tetrabenazine. The other thing that I would say, tetrabenazine usually is 3 times a day, right? So not all the patients they like or they don't have an environment supporting 3 times a day a regular prescription of this drug. This is for Huntington. Then, of course, it depends on the etiology of chorea. Then if you have autoimmune, of course, you do more the anti-immune treatment. Or also in sidenham chorea, you can use risperidone, tetrabenazine, and valproate besides the prophylaxis. So these drugs are quite well known and used in the majority of the world now.
Thank you. That's really interesting. Yeah, we don't have thiaprid in the US, as you probably know. And I mean, obviously, we're very nervous about people worsening the movement disorder, making people Parkinsonian with the dopamine D2 blocking agents. And I'm kind of a fan of quetiapine, I have to say, even though it shouldn't have G2 blocking features, especially when people have like a lot of agitation at night. I find that quite useful. We have several options, and it really is a matter of weighing the comorbidities, how much mood, agitation, psychosis there is, and depression. And it certainly would be great to have more psychiatrists on board to help us fine-tune these. But yes, the choice of whatever we use for the chorea is balanced with the risk of side effects and the other symptoms. So obviously you're an expert on deep brain stimulation. And so I would love to hear like what your experience is for deep brain stimulation in the hyperkinetics, the choreic disorders, in Huntington's disease, in other entities.
Thank you, Ruth. If I can tell you a story. Do you remember SARS, the first SARS, SARS-1 in Toronto? And not only in Toronto, but I was just arrived in Toronto. It was in 2003 when we started. I had a patient with Huntington disease, very severe chorea, and dystonia, gait impairment, but cognitively and from the psychiatry point of view, he was relatively preserved. And the Toronto group at that time was the first one in the world who had already operated another woman with Huntington disease and bilateral pallid GPI, the pallidum internum stimulation, with some mixed results. And so I asked Andres Lozano, why we don't operate this person? Because it doesn't have a major contraindication from the neuropsychiatric point of view. His major problem is chorea. Why we don't do it? And during that period, he got stuck in the hospital. So I had all, because of the SARS, and so I had all the time to try different parameters of stimulation. And which was a paper that we published after 1 year of follow-up in 2004. And we discovered a few things, because you have to know that in the literature, before DBS, they did some pallidotomy in Huntington, but the results were the disaster because the patients worsened. They became more Parkinsonian. And I always thought, what was the reason why they became more Parkinsonian? And indeed, when we started the stimulation, it was super interesting because the chorea swoop disappeared completely. Dystonia also improved, but if I use high frequency, the 130, which we use for Parkinson's disease and dystonia, I made the poor patient Parkinsonian, more Parkinsonian. He was under haloperidol also, but he was very mobile. If I use a frequency of 40 Hertz, the chorea was still very well improved, and it was much less Parkinsonian, and also gait improved. So I think that lesion, this is the reason why stimulation is not the same as making a lesion, was probably alterating much more all this oscillatory activity of the basal ganglia and reducing the frequency. Probably the networking was much less affected. The networking for bradykinesia and rigidity was much less involved. So that opened the eyes also for doing other patients with Huntington's disease. And that's also, if you read the literature, after there were several cases published with different results in the STN, also in the external part of the pallidus, there has been also some clinical trials in Germany with the pilot study with the mixed results, and a clinical trial just finished, but in almost 50 patients. We don't have the result published yet, but I think as much as I know that they found an improvement in chorea.
So dual electrodes, so both.
Yeah, but I think probably in one electrode, if it's in the right place, which is always the posterior ventral lateral part of the pallidum internum, it should work because it works for dystonia. It worked for chorea in the first case that I was talking to you. But the pallidum is not the best target for many surgeons because they're used to the STN. The pallidum is very big, so you need a good micro recording. So it's not actually an easy target. So there are still currently patients, we had one done here, who can benefit. But as I said, you have to operate people who are not so cognitively impaired and stable from the psychiatry point of view. If they have suicide attempts, you know, 1 month before the surgery, doesn't work very well, right? There are risk of having, not for the surgery, but of keeping this behavior. So this is the caveat. You have to select patients who are not so cognitive and psychiatric impaired. But otherwise, this GPI-DBS has been used also in chorea acanthocytosis, in ADCY5, GN01 for chorea. And in most of the cases, a good benefit in chorea has been reported.
And you would say this is with, so GPI, the posterior yeah. lateral ventral part, and low frequency stimulation, you would say would be the choice.
Yes. Absolutely. Then I think it probably depends on the severity of the disease. So how much is the basal ganglia damaged, probably, right? Or the huntingtin stuff, how many triplets, all this thing. But we don't have studies on that, right? We don't have study which can predict which patients can improve more. But probably there are some other characteristics besides this neuropsychiatry profile, which might also, you know, have an impact on the benefit you have in this patient.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and there also can be some other factors in the chorea acanthocytosis, VPS-13A disease. People can have a lot of obsessive compulsive behaviors. And so it'd be really interesting to talk about two targets.
The patient that we did with the GPI, they improved also this obsessive behavior and tics, and also this classical posture and the rubber gait. So the problem that is a neurodegenerative disease, right? So they might lose some benefit and other problem they arrive. But I think if we can, it's like the new treatment for Alzheimer, right? So if we can give this patient 1, 2, 3 years of good quality of life, I would go through, because the serious side effects, they are relatively rare, right? So I think it's the same concept. We should give these people the possibility to have an improving quality of life, even if it's 2, 3, 4 years.
You mentioned briefly the issue people are losing neurons in the basal ganglia throughout the disease course. Now, what about the issue of the electrode is obviously staying in place and the brain is kind of shrinking around it? Mm-hmm. What are your concerns in that area?
Well, as I said, we don't have a lot of data. The patient who I told you before, we had the follow-up up to 5 years. And in 5 years, you know, this disease is running fast. He was still having the same benefit. In chorea, not in gait. The gait disorders, the balance, they progressed. So the GPI was not effective anymore, but there was still some reduction. Because the pallidum is big. So I think even if there is some shrinking, it's not as big as, you know, if you lose the benefit. So I think this can explain why in that particular patient there was still a benefit. But as I said, we don't have a lot of data about very long term, so which can eventually support what you say.
I remember seeing some case reports with lead migration. I think,
but lead migration can be linked, can be related to, because you have to fix very nicely the electrode to the skull. You know, it might be also a problem related to the technique that the neurosurgeon used, right? So, because I really see this problem very rarely, also in children with dystonia, which, you know, they move a lot. So the electrode misplacement usually is a problem that they didn't fix it very well.
Okay. And then I know there was some successes reported in people with ADCY5 mutations. This is absolutely, not as far as I know, a neurodegenerative disease. Yeah. So certainly people who are in that situation, you would expect more sustained benefits. But as you say, we really need more long-term follow-up these people. So it's definitely something which you would consider in somebody with Huntington's disease, with neurocancer syndrome, where the chorea is very prominent.
Now, also post-stroke, right? Usually they go away, there is an improvement, spontaneous improvement, or with the medication that you use. Often, in some patients in whom chorea can persist and be disabling, GPI stimulation has been used, also thalamic, but especially GPI DBS has been used in some cases, like induced by maybe bleeding, cavernoma, all this kind of much rare issues has been reported. One side, of course, but
Right, as you mentioned, chorea following a structural lesion tends to get better with time, unlike with dystonia. But actually, one thing I didn't think of previously was like the Tardive syndromes, Tardive dyskinesia, which is often technically choreic. Is this something where you've done a lot of DBS?
We are lucky that we have a tetrabenazine, which works, and all your drugs, and also botulinum toxin, right? Sometimes it works, especially in the cervical part. Yes, the beauty of having a patient with tardive chorea or dystonia who does not improve with the medication botulinum toxin is that they respond really very nicely to bilateral GPI-DBS. Like a DYT1 population, they have a brilliant and long-standing response to bilateral GPI-DBS. We don't see them very often now because, psychiatrists, they change their way to treat patients, but they respond very well. Yeah, this patient responds very well.
Yeah, that's nice. Now, what about other surgical interventions? I know there's been some work on stem cell transplantation in Huntington's disease. I haven't heard anything on that in a while. What's your experience?
But you remember very well this more than 20 years old paper from France, actually, with the transplantations, it's a neural stem cell transplantation, which failed, right? So there was a big hope, and unfortunately, there was no major improvement in this patient. So as you said, there's been a bit abandoned, right? But there is an ongoing clinical trial using bone marrow stem cells, and another one using autologous stem cell from adipose tissue. So we don't know the results yet. We hope and we wish to see a benefit maybe in the progression of the disease, right? Because there's some study that they show now there is less atrophy, less progression of the disease with the MRI. We don't know if clinically we have a big advantage. But personally, I don't know. This is a genetic disease, right? So we know that the protein is the dysfunction is accumulating and the toxic, the mutated protein. So should just insist on gene therapy and, found a better way to not to cut all the wild protein, but just to target the toxic one. So I don't believe that this is a major area where to go, because as we have been failing for 20 years in this area. So probably with the new technique, gene therapy, it might have more hope or success in the next future.
Yeah, but I imagine one would translate striatal, fetal tracts, convert the neurons to striatal cells. But then again, that wouldn't be ideal because you said that the mutant protein is everywhere. It's in the cortex. And so that's probably accounting for a lot of the symptomatology. So,
and probably, Ruth, we have to target these patients much earlier. As we know, since when they are in the womb of the mother, they have already reducted cortical, thickness. We know this study actually was done here in Grenoble, right, by the first author. So I think that we should intervene much earlier with this kind of treatment. So we don't know. Maybe it's too late, right? It's too late yeah. when we do this kind of treatment.
So very interesting. So you're actually a lot more positive about the role of DBS for GPI in diseases like Huntington's. I'm actually a little surprised by that because it seems obviously you need to select the correct patients very carefully, those who are going to be able to tolerate it without significant cognitive or psychiatric issues, and obviously the appropriate situation where the family is going to be able to manage it. And then GPI and low frequency stimulation is the way to go. So it certainly sounds like a good option for the right people, buying them a few years of benefit when optimal medical management doesn't work so well.
Yeah, this is my impression.
you're the expert in this area. It's actually something I have not done, not so much myself for whatever reason. But yeah, my experience has mainly been somebody with choreocanthocytosis who had like a benefit for a couple of years and then it wore off. And that seems to be the way. So thank you so much. It's a really interesting discussion, and we look forward to learning more about the role of DBS and other therapies in these disorders. So thank you.
Thank you, and bye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Bye.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.